loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we have two segments. First, it's our regular Wednesday segment called In the News, where we talk about the biggest news of the week so far and put them into perspective. And then we continue our regular segment. It's every Wednesday called Beyond Nuclear, where we take a look at nuclear issues, including weapons, energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, former presidential advisor Roger Stone entered not guilty pleas on seven felony counts in a federal court in Washington, D.C. yesterday, and then immediately took to the airwaves to proclaim his innocence, to repeat that he will not testify against the president, and to warn the president that the Mueller investigation could mean the end of his presidency. Next, large-scale protests are taking place in Venezuela today after the Supreme Court moved to freeze Juan Guaido's bank accounts and to impose a travel ban on him. Guaido responded by calling on the military to side with him, and he asked the United States to send weapons and advisors to help him overthrow the government of President Nicolas Maduro. Then, Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats, CIA Director Gina Haspel, and FBI Director Christopher Wray delivered their annual intelligence threat assessment yesterday in an open hearing of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Notably, they contradicted Donald Trump on nearly every major issue, the Iranian and North Korean nuclear programs, ISIS, and China, for example. When asked directly if the president was hampering their abilities to do their jobs, all three declined to answer in an open forum. And then the U.S. and China met today to try to dig out from a damaging trade war with a new round of high-level talks aimed at bridging deep differences over China's intellectual property and technology transfer policies. U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer represented the U.S., while the Chinese delegation was led by Vice Premier Liu He. The deadline for the agreement is March 1st. And finally, the British Parliament yesterday narrowly failed to approve an amendment giving it the power to instruct Prime Minister Theresa May to seek a delay to avoid a disorderly and possibly chaotic exit from the European Union on March 29th. May later lost a non-binding amendment that said the UK should not leave the EU without a Brexit deal. And in other headlines, the bipartisan bicameral body that is tasked with ending the stalemate between President Trump and Congress over the border wall is meeting today. Trump tweeted earlier today, quote, "If the committee of Republicans and Democrats now meeting on border security is not discussing or contemplating a wall or physical barrier, they are wasting their time," unquote. Two ships sank in heavy seas off the coast of Djibouti yesterday, and the death toll has already mounted to 38. 16 survivors have been found so far, and one reported that there were 130 passengers on his ship alone. Scores of people are still missing, and the total number of the other vessel is still unclear. The Midwest today is grappling with terrible cold, called the polar vortex. The morning temperature in Chicago was 22 degrees below zero, which with wind chill felt like a negative 50. The polar vortex usually circles around the North Pole, but part of the air broke away and hit the U.S. Midwest instead, sending abnormally warm air to the North Pole. Despite four deaths already attributed to the extreme weather and the substantial homeless populations, especially in the cities, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker remarked about the front, quote, "We need everyone to do your part and make sure you and your families are prepared." Texas is preparing for the first U.S. execution of 2019 with a possible execution of Robert Mitchell Jennings today at 6 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. Eastern. The Supreme Court is considering a last-minute stay. Jennings is now 61 years old and faced a terrible upbringing and developmental disabilities. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the news so far this week. It's Wednesday. That means it's time for our weekly segment called In the News, where we look at the most important ongoing developments of the week so far and put them into perspective. At the end of the week, on Friday, we spend the full hour with the Week in Review. And again, we have the same guests in both segments. We're joined from Washington by Jackie Lookman. She is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Jackie, Walter, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Happy to be here.
Walter, let's start with you real quick. Yeah, the U.S. coup effort could not be more brazen against Venezuela. I mean, in all ways. It's sort of more brazen than all of the other CIA U.S. coups in the last, I don't know, when did the CIA form, John?
1947.
When it took the place of OSS?
That's right. And it immediately launched an overthrow of the Italian Communist Party.
Yeah. And then, of course, on to Iran with the 1953 overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran. His crime was he nationalized the Iranian oil company. Then another, quote, dictator, that would be the Arbenz government in 1954, was overthrown. The crime there was Arbenz nationalized United Fruit Company plantations in Guatemala and thought maybe these profits should be used to help feed Guatemalans instead of Wall Street investors. So, of course, the forces for democracy had to swing into action, Walter, to topple another government. And here we are, 2019, again, always a noble cause for the overthrow of these governments, but this one is in full swing.
It is remarkable how brazen it is. John Bolton is even publicly commenting about how, you know, he's consulting with the representatives of different oil corporations. Venezuela has the largest oil reserves in the world. That's one of the reasons why the U.S. wants to take them out. It has nothing to do with democracy. Another reason is that they're sort of a symbol of an alternative model for Latin America and really for the world that challenges the hegemony both of the United States and of big corporations in general. And so, you know, what's going on in Venezuela right now, I think, is, you know, a classic coup push orchestrated by the United States government in alliance with local elites. But the big difference, though, is that, you know, the government in Venezuela, the elected government, just last year, there was an election. They're basically, you know, standing strong right now. There's large mobilizations of supporters of the Bolivarian Revolution, the process of change that began in 1998 when Hugo Chavez was elected. And the military, too, as a consequence of many years of sort of the creation of this new patriotic officer corps, have been, you know, remaining loyal to the constitutional order. And so the United States, seeing that, you know, their coup plot is kind of sputtering out, they amped up the economic pressure. Yesterday, they announced a de facto oil embargo to try to further squeeze the Venezuelan economy and deepen the economic crisis that they themselves were a major cause of.
Yeah, I wanted to add something. One of the things that disturbs me very much is something that we talk about on this show a lot, and that is international law. This is such a clear, flagrant, brazen violation of international law that the United Nations should be up in arms. And it's not. Even the Russians and Chinese have not called for a UN Security Council hearing. Now, of course, the US would veto anything, but at the very least, you need to get something like this on the record. We've seen no action in the UN General Assembly. And on the contrary, we've seen countries line up in the last couple of days to endorse Juan Guaido as the legitimate president of Venezuela. And of course, this is under pressure from the United States, but at least outside of Venezuela, this is not going well.
Jackie Lookman, Elliot Abrams has been appointed by Donald Trump to be the envoy to Venezuela. Now, Elliot Abrams is a super right-wing interventionist hawk. He was convicted of crimes during the Iran-Contra scandal in the 1980s. That was during the Reagan administration. The Reagan administration was barred by Congress from sending more weapons to the Contras, to the counter-revolutionary former Somoza National Guard. Somoza was the dictator who was toppled by the Sandinista Revolution. Elliot Abrams and his cohorts in the Reagan administration did all kinds of deals to be able to illegally circumvent the congressional decision on sending arms to Nicaragua. He was convicted. But during that time, during the Reagan administration, during the last months of the Reagan administration, Elliot Abrams was demanding, insisting on the invasion, the U.S. invasion of Panama. Now, Ronald Reagan said no to that at the time because he was worried that it would hurt H.W. Bush's election efforts in case the invasion went badly. So it was put on hold. Then George H.W. Bush came into office January 20th, 1989. Elliot Abrams was in that administration. And on December 20th, 1989, George H.W. Bush went to war against Panama, seized the Panamanian head of state, and brought him, a la the Roman Empire, back to the prisons of the home country.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah. Anyway, Jackie Lookman, this is old style and new style imperialism. Old style because it is like the Roman Empire.
Yeah, and I think this entire situation in Venezuela points to a couple of things that are real problems in the American electorate, in American society. Our lack of political history, number one, and our lack of history in general, as it really does exist, and our lack of focus on foreign policy and the importance of foreign policy, of United States foreign policy around the world. It's amazing to me how even our democratic elected officials are parroting a part of this narrative that Maduro is a dictator and he's an evil person and, you know, he's the problem in Venezuela. But then they'll turn around and say, well, but, you know, we're not supporting U.S. intervention. I mean, you can't combat this issue of this blatant United States coup in Venezuela with like a half truth. You can't sort of say, well, yeah, I see why Trump is doing this, but we just don't like the way he's doing it, which is what it seems like to me that they're saying. And people in America are parroting this narrative because they don't know this history that's connected to these people, to the Elliott Abrams and to the Reagan administration and the Bush administration and the kind of soft imperialist things that the Obama administration did in the same Latin American countries. So, it's horrifying to see Democrats not push back on, with the exception of a few, not push back on this pro-imperialist message that halfway demonizes Maduro, but then claims to not back a military coup.
Jackie Lookman raises really, really important point here.
Absolutely.
Really important point, because even liberals, even progressives who oppose the coup, they feel obliged, because there's so much demonization of Maduro, to say, of course, Maduro is corrupt, or if he's not personally corrupt, there's a lot of corruption. Of course there's corruption, because there's corruption everywhere. Or they say he's cracked down on protesters in Venezuela, thus he's a violator of human rights. Okay, let's go to America. Let's go to America. Donald Trump lost the election by 3 million votes. I mean, a lot of people might say Donald Trump's not a legitimate president. Would any of these same people then turn around and say, well, it's true that other countries shouldn't come in and invade the United States and topple the government and seize its assets? It's true they shouldn't do that, but let's make it clear Donald Trump's not legitimate, meaning maybe they're on the right track, but using different tactics. No, nobody questions the legitimacy of Macron or Theresa May or Donald Trump, even though you can condemn them for all kinds of reasons. They are the official legal heads of state, and so is Maduro.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. And especially when you consider what these people who, you know, otherwise might be posturing as progressives want to have happen in the United States, all the social programs that they advocate for. Well, look, Venezuela has implemented all those things. Venezuela has made enormous progress, in the past 20 years since the Bolivarian Revolution started, since Chavez came in. 73% of Venezuela's budget goes towards social programs. I mean, isn't that a model that, you know, people who are progressive should want to emulate here rather than go and condemn at their moment of greatest need?
Yeah, and just to pick up on that, and John and Jackie, jump in if you want. You know, if a powerful country, the most powerful in the world, imposes fierce, severe economic sanctions, cuts you off from international markets, it says to other third parties, we're going to hold you in the dock if you dare trade with this country. And then there's lots of economic problems. This is an emerging economy, not a developed economy. Lots of problems. Well, of course there's going to be economic problems. Then why put the onus on the Maduro government? Like, the Maduro government wants there to be food lines? I mean, obviously, this is a tried and true tactic of U.S. destabilization efforts of governments prior to their overthrow.
Yeah, absolutely true. But one of the things that's different this time is that it's so public. I'm just shocked at the brazenness where the U.S. government, the Trump administration, doesn't care one whit about what the people of Venezuela want, doesn't care at all about the illegality of recognizing someone who is essentially just an imposition in a position of authority in Venezuela, and how the Democrats have just lined right up behind him. There's almost no one on Capitol Hill who's willing to stand up and say this is wrong. It's an extension of American hegemony. It's imperialist and it's illegal. Nobody's saying that.
Yeah. In fact, Jackie, Washington Post today approvingly in their headline, the suggestion from the headline approving of Donald Trump, who they say they're all against Donald Trump every other day of the year, approving the fact that not only has the Trump administration seized Venezuela's bank accounts, but turned them over to Guaido, who Pence and Trump say is now the president of Venezuela, the opposition. How do you go in and steal a country's financial assets, hand them over to the opposition, and then have people who say, well, we're anti-Trump, we're part of the anti-Trump resistance, say, oh, no, that's a good thing.
Right. They're handing these assets that the profits would go to the people of Venezuela over to a guy that did not run in the last election. So the people of Venezuela didn't have the opportunity to vote for him or not. He boycotted, I think, the election before, didn't want to negotiate with the Maduro government for anything, and has already made deals with the United States and other Western countries to privatize these assets. So when you don't connect what the United States did in Cuba, when you believe that Cuba is allegedly economically backward because of a corrupt and brutal dictator, and not because of sanctions that the United States imposed on Castro and any other country that wanted to do business with Castro after the revolution there. And then you don't connect that truth to what Mike Pompeo said about Iran just a couple of weeks ago, when he just blatantly came out and said, well, we're going to impose these new sanctions on Iran, and it's up to the Iranian government whether its people eat or not. I mean, there is no way you can look at what's being done in Venezuela now if you understand all of that history and not see that it's not just illegal, it's also immoral. But we're not educated toward understanding foreign policy or even believing that anything that the United States government does in foreign countries could possibly be wrong. So we've got these narratives out there that are hard to combat.
Hard to combat and very, very important to combat. Every time the United States plans to intervene and overthrow a country, dissolve its army, before that happens, the American people are psychologically prepared to accept this new crime. And it is a crime. And the way the preparation takes place is through the vehicle of demonization. It's a thing. You demonize Saddam Hussein. You demonize Muammar Gaddafi. You demonize Manuel Noriega. You demonize Assad in Syria. You demonize every leader. Then the progressive people who are considered kind of liberal or whatever say, oh, of course, I join in the condemnation of the targeted entity that's being demonized, but we shouldn't go to war. Now, if you're supporting sanctions, as some people did in the anti-war movement against Iraq before the first Gulf War, if you're supporting sanctions and say, let's have a different approach towards overthrowing governments, let's use peaceful means like economic sanctions. Well, guess what? Economic sanctions are a form of war, an insidious form of war. You're depriving civilians of food and medicine. The people in high places are not going to go without food. It's against the masses of people. It's war.
It's a war. And it's also, I mean, let's think about like what the actual record of Venezuela is. In the United States, Venezuela provides free heating oil for poor and working class people in Native American reservations in the United States. In the South Bronx, they provided free heating oil.
In Massachusetts.
Yeah, in Massachusetts. Yeah. I mean, it's completely contrary to the actual experience that people in the United States have had with Venezuela. But because all of the information that we get is filtered through these handful of corporate media monopolies that all parrot the exact same line, the exact same talking points that they get essentially from the CIA, from the State Department, and from the Pentagon. All of that is lost. The fact that Venezuela has offered to help recover from hurricanes, help the U.S. recover from hurricanes, all of that is lost when we just look at everything through the prism of the mainstream media narrative that's repeated over and over again in this and other regime change operations where it's the people versus the dictator. But what we don't see are the photos, for instance, of what's going on today, where there are massive, massive mobilizations of tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of government supporters. We only see photos and video of opposition actions. And it, by the way, not the violent ones, not the ones where they're stringing piano wire across intersections so that people driving by on scooters are decapitated.
That's Guaido's party, too. That's popular will. That was their tactic.
Good
They'd string metal pieces of a wire across roads, and as motorcyclists came through, and these were working class neighborhoods, they would be literally decapitated.
Yeah, and you know, by the way, we had Dan Cohen on the show yesterday, and he and Max Blumenthal just finished an article. I learned something there that's very important. You know, where did Guaido come from? That's kind of a long question or a long answer. But fundamentally, how did he become the head of the National Assembly when he's like a totally unknown person? Okay, well,
81% of Venezuelans have never heard of him before he became their president.
The president, yeah, right. And so there's an agreement between, I think, the four main opposition parties in the National Assembly that they would rotate the presidency of the National Assembly. And so it was his party's turn. It was this extreme right party, Popular Will's turn. Now, the head of the Popular Will party, Leopoldo Lopez, he's in prison because he orchestrated these riots where people were being decapitated, where, you know, mortars were being launched into public housing projects, where, you know, an Afro-Venezuelan was lit on fire because, you know,
several, actually.
Yeah, right. And so, okay, so he's in prison. That's probably good, right? And then there's the deputy head of Popular Will, who would be next in line, right? Freddy Guevara. But he's been hiding out in the Chilean embassy for like 2 years because of his role coordinating these riots. And so it was the third in command of like one of the four parties who happened to be Juan Guaido.
Yeah, the new leader. Jackie Lookman, let's deal with one more piece of this. Again, showing the imperial character of what's going on. A couple days ago, the United Kingdom, again, one of the great colonizers of the world, and really Britain has no right to talk about how much it cares about the human rights and democratic desires of people in colonized or former colonized countries, because it was the entity that deprived them of those rights. But nonetheless, the government in the UK seized $1.2 billion of gold that the Venezuelan government had in British banks, $1.2 billion in gold, and is turning it over or trying to turn it over to Guaido, the opposition. It reminded me that 103 years ago, Woodrow Wilson ordered the U.S. invasion of Haiti. That was in 1915. The U.S. Marines marched right to the central bank in Port-au-Prince, seized all of the gold of the country, and transferred the gold to the First National City Bank in New York. They just took it. Here we are 103 years later. It's the same thing. They're seizing the gold of the countries that are trying to emerge from colonialism. Unlike Woodrow Wilson, though, who didn't have to pretend it's about democracy, these guys do. But it's the same thing.
Yeah, it's the exact same thing. And Haiti is such an excellent example because look at the state of Haiti now, the economic state, the social state, the political state. We are still demonizing Haiti in this country as a backward country that can't govern itself. But their economy was stolen. Literally, their economy, their ability to provide services for their citizens based on their own resources was stolen from them, and they have never been allowed to be self-sufficient, to determine their own direction, to be self-determinate as a sovereign nation. And they've always been held under the grip of imperialist power by these puppet dictators that they've repeatedly ousted, who have been installed or attempted to be installed by the United States. The exact same thing is going on. Or they're trying to do the exact same thing in Venezuela. They're just being really ham-fisted about it. As you guys said earlier, the CIA, in between what happened in Haiti and what recently happened in the last 50 years when we've done this in Chile, in Cuba, they've been a little bit more finessed about it. They've been more subversive about it. But this administration are bulls in the China shop. So they're just going to come out and tell you, we're taking your stuff and we don't care.
Jackie, we only have 3 minutes left. Gosh, we spent all of our half an hour on Venezuela. There's so many other big issues. We're going to do those, though, on Friday when we do the weekend review. So this is a big topic. I'm not sad that we did this. But in our last 3 minutes, the Democrats, Jackie, are at war with each other because some of them have dared to raise the prospect of Medicare for all. Again, Kamala Harris is walking back her comments on that. You know, what is not part of this discussion is this fact. The Republicans and the conservative Democrats all say Medicare for all is too expensive, right? That's their line. It's too expensive. Guess what? They said the same thing when the original Medicare bill was introduced in 1964.
They said the same thing about the Social Security Act in the
1930s. Yeah, they said this is going to bankrupt the country. Now, it's the same arguments. The Republicans filibustered against Medicare, that is the Medicare for old people in 1964. They said it'll bankrupt the country. Now, if you took Medicare from old people right now, there would be a revolution in America against whoever tried to do that. It's the same damn argument. 2 minutes left, Jackie.
Yeah, it's the same argument. And unfortunately, the Democratic Party is horrible, horrible, horrible on messaging and its own recognizing history of politics. This isn't even a difficult argument to combat because all you have to say is Medicare for all can't possibly bankrupt the country when all of these wars that we have fought endlessly hasn't bankrupted the country yet. But these people don't have the spine to say that, because they are getting money from the same group of people who are paying the Republicans to trot out this tired line of these social programs are going to bankrupt the country.
Jackie's right. John Kiriakou, it hasn't bankrupted, say, England, the
Absolutely
UK.
Absolutely not.
It didn't bankrupt Canada. It hasn't bankrupted France. And it hasn't bankrupted Germany.
The Scandinavian countries, which have...
They must be bankrupt. It must be awful to live in those countries. Again, because guess what? When you get sick, and we all do get sick, and our children get sick, and our parents get sick, they have to go to a doctor. Why treat healthcare as a commodity?
Yeah. I was living in London in college, and my girlfriend got very sick, and I took her to the hospital, and they treated her. They admitted her. And then they let her out the next day, cured. It didn't cost one red cent.
I was in Chiapas during the Zapatista uprising. Somebody got hurt or sick there. We went to the hospital later when we got back to Mexico City. We were all thinking, oh, how are we going to pay for this? No bill.
Yeah.
At the end. That's Mexico.
Yeah.
But America, the largest country in the world, so exceptional that it can't have healthcare for its people. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We've been joined from Washington, D.C. by Jackie Lookman. Jackie is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we were joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our regular segment. It's every Wednesday called Beyond Nuclear, where we take a look at nuclear issues, including weapons, energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. We're joined in the studio by Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. You can read his writings and learn about their group at beyondnuclear.org. We're also joined this week by Walter Smolarek, Sputnik News analyst. Walter, you're sitting in for Nicole Roussel, who's usually here.
That's true.
You have to
step
up.
Glad to be here, though.
Nicole will be back with us on Friday. Kevin, there's many issues. Of course, there's the nuclear energy issues. We want to talk about that because there's a lot going on. Your organization and other organizations are fighting the fight, actually, to protect people in New Mexico and people in the southwest part of the country, and in fact, people all over the country, from the great dangers posed by the nuclear industry. I do also want to have a moment during this half-hour conversation to talk about some of the nuclear weapons issues, because the leaders of U.S. intelligence agencies were back before Congress yesterday, and of course, nuclear weapons in North Korea or the absence of nuclear weapons in Iran, those became issues. We want to touch on that. But before we get there, let's go to the sort of the battle of the day. And that battle, of course, is the one you've been waging. Go ahead.
The week that I'm just coming back from in New Mexico was very intense. We had four legal teams opposing what would be the largest nuclear waste dump in the world, a high-level radioactive waste dump in southeastern New Mexico with 173,000 metric tons of highly radioactive waste. So that's 2.5 times the size of the Yucca Mountain dump targeted at Nevada. And we more than held our own. It was pretty apparent, I think, to any objective observer how half-baked this proposal is. And incredibly enough, the lead attorney for Holtec, who happens to hail from the Pillsbury Law Firm, which is just a block from your studio here, admitted late in the process in a two-day hearing that, yes, indeed, the process, the project, the proposal is illegal on a certain level because the Department of Energy can only take title and ownership of irradiated nuclear fuel at an operating repository, a permanent disposal site. This is not that. This is a centralized interim storage facility. So he acknowledged and said, yes, you're right. But we also have the option of private companies, you know, contracting with us to store their waste out here. And, you know, this was the part that really got me. The law can be changed. And our attorney, Diane Curran, who's also based in the neighborhood here, actually, for Beyond Nuclear, she said that we really should not have to be litigating a hypothetical. That's really a violation of the Administrative Procedures Act on a very basic level.
And just basic logic, too. I mean, that was their legal argument, that because the regulations may change in the future, then therefore we now have the right to carry out this incredibly dangerous project.
What's the definition of a regulation then?
Incredibly, they said not just the regulations, which the NRC, we should get to on the show today, the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, just changed its regulations in a really bad way. Yeah, regulations do change. But what the lawyer for Holtec said was the law could be changed. And they actually put it in their filings a couple times in the last several months that, you know, there was a big vote in Congress in the House last May that would legalize all this stuff. Of course, it didn't pass the Senate. So it's like, yeah, well, anything could happen in the future. Therefore, let me do this or that. So it was theater of the absurd. And another big whopper, you mentioned the suspension of logic or whatever out there, was it got gasps from the audience, actually, when Holtec's lawyer said, the reason we don't have to worry about leaks at the site in this biggest nuclear waste dump on the planet is that they're not going to happen. Therefore, we don't have to address it in our license application. And people just kind of, you know, laughed and fell out of their chairs like, well, I assume that I'm never going to die, therefore, you know, I'm not going to save any money for retirement, you know, that kind of attitude.
Wow, that's astonishing. And just, I mean, what are the specific health and environmental issues that could arise from this? Even though, you know, the lawyers claim, well, that'll never happen. What actually could, in fact, happen based on experience?
Well, another issue they didn't want to deal with, they said, we don't want to think about it because we've decided it's completely safe, is the transportation. So to get 173,000 metric tons, which is more than twice what exists in the United States right now, of high-level waste out to New Mexico, you have to transport it there by train, by truck, by barge. Accidents could happen. They decided they don't want to deal with it. So look at a real-world accident that happened in July of 2001. It was a tunnel fire beneath downtown Baltimore. There was a study done by the state of Nevada, which has been fighting the Yucca Mountain dump for a generation now. And they looked at a Holtec container, the very company we're talking about in New Mexico. What if there had been a Holtec container in that real-world fire? And they decided it would have breached, and then the casualty rates are, you know, off the charts. Inevitably, scores of people would have died from latent cancer fatalities from their initial exposures to the smoke coming out of the tunnel. But if people kept living in the contaminated areas of downtown Baltimore after a year's exposure, 1,500 people would die from cancer. It may take them 10, 20, 30 years to die, but their exposure in that first year would cause their fatal cancer. And then after 50 years of exposure, 30,000 plus latent cancer fatalities. So those are the risks of transport.
What would you have to do if an accident like that actually did take place, which, you know, as you're pointing out, is entirely plausible? I mean, would you have to evacuate like a major city?
Yeah, you would have to evacuate, but you could clean up. But the figure that the Nevada report came up with was a $14 billion cleanup bill to bring the contamination down to acceptable levels. You'd still have health damage. It just wouldn't be those figures they gave you. But, you know, there have been efforts during the George W. Bush administration, and now on the last day of the Obama administration, they're called Protective Action Guidelines for Nuclear Emergencies. where incredibly, Obama's EPA chief, she signed off on this thing that allowed radionuclide contaminants to go up by orders of magnitude, in some cases a millionfold or millionsfold under a nuclear emergency. That's how bad the contamination can be. And they won't necessarily evacuate. That's the thing. That's why they're weakening the regulations, so they wouldn't have to do an evacuation.
So let's go back. So how did the rest of the hearing, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission hearing, go? I mean, what was sort of the conclusion of it, at least, you know, for as long as you were there?
Well, what it was all about was, do we have legal standing? Are our contentions, our legal objections meritorious or not? And we will find out by late March, early April, is what the licensing board said. We still have filings to do because of things that were said in this hearing. We're going to keep fighting this thing at every turn. And I think, you know, Beyond Nuclear, for example, we have members, supporters within a mile of the proposed site who actually ranch their cattle right up to the fence line. So if we can't establish standing, nobody can. And the merits of our arguments, we had 42 legal objections all told across the coalition. So if none of them are meritorious, you can begin to see how rigged this thing is against us. But we've made clear, and we've already filed papers with the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, we're going straight to federal court as soon as we're exhausted at our administrative remedies at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
Kevin, I want to go back and remind our audience, because this is a lot of dense information and it's a little bit hard to completely grab hold of unless you're following the subject as you do every day and every hour and every minute and as we do once a week. But I want to go back and read what you wrote to help us understand what's actually happening at the licensing thing, where we started, and again, remind our audience about the illegality of what's going on. The Federal Nuclear Waste Policy Act of 1982, as amended, only allows the U.S. Department of Energy, the DOE, to take ownership of irradiated nuclear fuel at an operating permanent geologic repository. Such a title and liability transfer to DOE at the, quote, interim site proposed by Ultec is not allowed. And then you wrote, the wise precaution was included in the law to safeguard against a, quote, interim, close quote, surface site becoming a de facto permanent site in the absence of a permanent repository. And that's what this is. Whatever you call it, when you create this kind of waste dump in New Mexico, it's not going away. It's permanent. I mean,
literally permanent forever.
Yeah, forever. And so here you have the law being on our side, our meaning the people's side. That's all important, because when you go out and organize people and you think you tell them we're demanding X, Y, and Z, people might think, well, that sounds right. But of course, you're up against power here. You're up against a really, really powerful, well-funded, deep-pocketed industry with lots of connections to Congress. I don't know. It sounds impossible to beat them. But then if you also say, but guess what? The law is actually on our side. That makes a big difference psychologically in terms of organizing.
Well, you know why that precautionary provision is in there is because small states, sparsely populated states, relatively speaking, like Nevada, like New Mexico, as long ago as 1982, when the Nuclear Waste Policy Act was passed, they saw what was coming their way. And sure enough, by 1987, the Screw Nevada Bill, which said we're only looking at Yucca Mountain, Nevada for a permanent repository. So the small states were able to defend themselves a little bit by saying that, well, if you're going to have a temporary storage site for this stuff, there has to be an open permanent dump site or else you're going to be stuck with it forever. It's going to become de facto permanent. And you asked, Walter, about the risks. The risks of this becoming de facto permanent, the Department of Energy has admitted that with loss of institutional control, with degradation of the waste containers over time, you're going to have releases into the environment at catastrophic levels of this hazardous radioactivity. That can happen at reactor sites. That can happen at a centralized interim storage facility in New Mexico. And so Nevada, for a generation now, and now New Mexico, which turned blue on Election Day just now, Nevada is still defending itself against the Yucca dump, and New Mexico, more and more, is stepping up as a state government, as a congressional delegation, and this issue of de facto permanent. And John mentioned it is permanent. We had to take in this case, the Environmental Protection Agency to court in the Yucca process and got them to admit a million years of hazard going forward at Yucca Mountain. They wanted to cut off regulations at 10,000 years. That's just the beginning. And Yucca might have performed, probably not, but might have performed for 10,000 years without leaking massively. But ironically enough, at 11,000 years, it was pretty clear it was going to leak massively. And so that was a huge court victory for us, for them to acknowledge a million years of hazard.
A million years of hazard. And inevitably, it will leak. And inevitably, the environment will be harmed and people will die, possibly in very, very large numbers. You know, let's just talk about the human beings who are involved in this process, because what you're telling the people, what you're exposing, is something that they know all about. They can minimize it. They can rationalize it. They can say it's unlikely, but they know it's a real danger. And the government laws and regulations are constructed with also these provisos in mind, that this is real, that this is a real danger. How does the human being on the other side actually come to the decision, you know what, it's okay by me that we're going to create this long-term permanent risk that inevitably will harm and kill people, men, women, and children? How do they come to this decision? How do they, quote, live with themselves, close quote? And, you know, some of them will go to church on Sunday or to the synagogue or to the mosque, and they'll pray to their God, and they'll think, oh, you know what, I'm leading a religious life. I'm doing right by my community, by my God, by my family. And on Monday morning, I'm going to go in and make sure that the people who are exposing these truths don't succeed. How do you explain that kind of human behavior? There has to be an explanation.
Well, there's that Upton Sinclair quote essentially saying people are blinded by dollar signs. If their paycheck requires them to see things one way, they will see it that way. And you know, what's interesting about what we just experienced is you had the local governments in southeastern New Mexico send their people up, Eddy County, Lee County, the cities of Carlsbad and Hobbs, who are in favor of this dump because the nuclear industry has had its claws in that part of New Mexico for a very long time. The waste isolation pilot plant is a dump site for military plutonium. There's other nuclear facilities down there, uranium enrichment. It all began back in 1942 with Los Alamos, Oppenheimer setting up shop in northern New Mexico during the Manhattan Project. So there's this economic interest. But what was interesting was our plaintiffs, the people who got us legal standing, who live down there, they don't see it this way. And one of our declarants pointed out that if you walk down the streets of Carlsbad, which is the company town for this dump, and asked 10 people, 100 people, if they knew about it, probably 99% of the people in Carlsbad, the company town, the town that's so proud of this proposal, the people don't even know about it, what's going on. And that's how they get away with it. And there's only a certain group of people who are going to make money on this thing. You asked about the risks, Walter, and another risk is security to the transports, but also to the storage. Incredibly enough, the figure for how many security guards they're going to have, I think it's 4 or 5 per shift. And, you know, it adds up to a few dozen, maybe. This is the biggest concentration of radioactivity on the planet, and they're going to have a few dozen security guards, all told, paid a glorified minimum wage. So there aren't a lot of people making a lot of money off this thing. They're going to try to just pocket all the money themselves. That's what's so outrageous.
Yeah, that's astonishing. And, you know, it seems to me like, you know, the legal rationale that the corporation is putting forward here for why they're allowed to do this, that, well, we're not allowed to now, but maybe in the future the regulations will change, so we should just go ahead and do it. It's so absurd that the only way that they could possibly think that something like that would succeed is if they have serious political connections, right? I mean, like deep, you know, paid for political connections. Can you talk about that a little bit? I mean, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and any of the other government agencies involved, I mean, how are they influenced by the political power of big business?
Well, a big regulatory change was just voted on in recent days at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It was a 3-2 party line vote. The 3 Republicans voted in favor. The 2 Democrats, one of them's an independent, but he was an Obama appointee, voted against. And what would it do? It would unlearn any lessons learned from Fukushima Daiichi. So we talked on a previous show about NRC Chairman Greg Yasko, who demanded that lessons be learned and applied from Fukushima in this country. And his head was taken off. He was forced from his position, essentially. And his replacements, so to speak, have just voted that floods and earthquakes at American reactors need not be worried about. In the aftermath of Fukushima, and what's incredible about that is we have dozens of Fukushima twin designs in this country. We have one plant with 3 Fukushima twin designs below a giant dam in the Carolinas that is vulnerable to earthquakes. And we have NRC whistleblowers who've said if that dam breaches, it will be Fukushima, almost an identical Fukushima catastrophe. It'll be 16-foot deep water that hits that plant and likely it's all going to go up in flames. And so incredibly, the three Republicans, one is Svinicki. She's the chairman under Trump, and she was a DOE official before she became a top staffer on Capitol Hill, working for pro-nuclear Republicans on the Senate, the senator from Idaho, Larry Craig. Another Trump appointee is Annie Caputo, who was an Exelon nuclear lobbyist before she became a top Capitol Hill staffer in both houses for pro-nuclear Republican members. And then the third vote was David Wright from South Carolina, president of the Public Service Commission, who presided over the waste of $9 billion of ratepayer money on two new reactors that are abandoned now. These are the people who just voted to disallow safety regulation in the face of potential earthquakes and floods at American reactors.
Yeah, and just to remind our listeners, I mean, when you say a Fukushima, another Fukushima event, I mean, just how bad, just how devastating was that?
Fukushima Daiichi is regarded as the second worst nuclear power disaster in human history. But, I mean, we had a Russian top-level biologist touring the United States as Fukushima unfolded in 2011. He was an expert on Chernobyl, Yablokov. And he pointed out that Fukushima could easily become the worst nuclear disaster because of where it happened in densely populated Japan. And here we have a big part of the Fukushima cover-up. Why you don't hear much about it, if anything, is because the Olympics are going to be hosted in Tokyo and surrounding areas in the summer of 2020. That's been the Japanese government's excuse since 2012, essentially, to not say anything negative about the situation because they're going to host the Olympics. In some cases, the venues are on radioactively contaminated sites. So the first casualty of war and nuclear disasters is the truth.
Indeed. We're talking with Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. Go to their website, beyondnuclear.org. Read about what they're doing. I mean, these epic battles, David and Goliath battles to keep people safe, to keep this country safe against a predatory industry, the nuclear energy industry, motivated by greed and avarice and a lot of corruption. And when we talk about corruption, talking about a lot of corrupt politicians who have been bought and paid for by the nuclear industry. Again, it seems to me to be like such common sense, but we always have this dilemma where material interests, and in particular, corrupted material interests have undue influence. You know, you can read all the literature, Henry Ibsen's Enemy of the People, or the movie Jaws, where, you know, where the town mayor is told, don't tell people there's a great big shark in the water that's going to possibly eat you up because it's going to hurt the tourist business. Again, this kind of dilemma, these kind of struggles go on. And we talk about all of them every week in this segment called Beyond Nuclear. Kevin Camps, we have about 10 minutes left. Where do we want to go next? What's our next story?
Well, there's breaking news, like from North Korea, that the Russian government was offering a nuclear power plant to the North Koreans in exchange for them dismantling their plutonium production. And so that just came to light. Apparently, the offer was made late last year. So it's interesting because it's reflective of U.S. efforts under Clinton. Even Carter was involved as a emissary of the Clinton administration. And again, the U.S. was offering nuclear power plants to the North Koreans in exchange for standing down on nuclear weapons. The problem is, you know, the Russian offer was that, well, any waste would be returned to Russia so that it couldn't fall into the wrong hands of North Korea and be made into weapons. Well, it's a risk, though, you know. So that's our point, is why not go renewable? Why not take advantage of the shoreline of North Korea for not only wind energy, but tidal energy? You can't make nuclear weapons out of wind energy, you know. So when is our species going to learn this and do the right thing? Because one of these days, you know, these bombs are going to be used. And as we speak, I mean, another development is, incredibly enough, the U.S. government has just announced, very kind of quietly, but it's kind of big news, so it's kind of getting out there, that they are building new nuclear weapons. It's called the W-76-2. And all they're doing is they're taking the secondary, the big explosion, out of this bomb that already exists and just going with the spark plug, which is still going to be, you know, a third or more the size of Hiroshima. And it's this usable nuclear weapons idea. So down in the Texas Panhandle, the facility's called Pantex, they've announced that they're making these things. And that's, you know, at the same time that the Russian government has announced hypersonic weaponry that is soon to be deployed. So we're in a new arms race. And unfortunately, the weapons being made are more usable.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's just the thing with nuclear weapons is that, well, you know, it seems unthinkable. Nuclear weapons could never possibly be used because they're so because they're so devastating that it could end all life on Earth, right? I mean, it would be the end of human civilization. But when you look at the actual history of nuclear weapons, right, not only were they, of course, used twice in Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945, but there are all these other instances where nuclear war almost broke out, like in Korea, right? I mean, in 1953, the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff unanimously voted to drop nuclear weapons along the border of North Korea and China should peace negotiations fail. And luckily, those negotiations succeeded. But I mean, there is so many near misses. You know, the Cuban Missile Crisis is another one. The Able Archer exercises in 1983. The threat of nuclear war is always present as long as those nuclear weapons exist.
Yeah, and of course, the idea of the elimination of the species, that was a consequence of what is called mutually assured destruction. Meaning, because in 1945, when the U.S. used nuclear weapons, it wasn't the elimination of the species. It was simply the elimination of several hundred thousand humans who happened to live in Hiroshima or Nagasaki. Then the Russians developed a counterweight to the American, what was then, a monopoly on nuclear weapons. The monopoly ended. Both sides had nuclear weapons. Over time, there was a recognition that if a nuclear war started, both sides would use their nuclear weapons. That would basically do, as Walter is suggesting, end life as we know it, at least, on the planet. Again, what you're talking about, though, Kevin, is, and you called it W76-2, we're talking about the Pentagon looking for ways to use nuclear weapons in such a battlefield scenario that would avoid mutually assured destruction. I don't know how you actually do once you climb the nuclear ladder, but in other words, lower yield battlefield nuclear weapons that can devastate an enemy but not pose the threat of international thermonuclear war. Nonetheless, it opens up a door to the use of nuclear weapons once again.
And to be fair, I mean, the Trump administration's position is that we're doing this to counter the Russians, who are doing it too, who are developing usable nuclear weapons, or they're called tactical nuclear weapons, battlefield nuclear weapons, as opposed to strategic, which are city killers. But a point that was made in the Washington Post coverage of this by Hans Christensen with Federation of American Scientists is that once you start the nukes, forget about it. And one problem is that the W76-1, this is a hydrogen bomb, a city killer, and the W76-2, a tactical battlefield explosive, which is still big, a third the size of Hiroshima, they're launched on the same cruise missile. And so his point was pretty apt that, so what is the incoming adversary supposed to do as they see this missile incoming? They're supposed to wait for the mushroom cloud to reveal itself to see how big it is before they decide how to respond. They're probably going to respond before it detonates, and they might assume that it's a hydrogen bomb.
Well, they will assume that. I mean, you have to, under those circumstances, especially you're accountable. You're on the other side. You detect the incoming missile. You don't know if it's the big one, the hydrogen bomb, or just the little one, a third the size of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Again, a bomb that killed 100,000 people immediately. You don't know, but you can't afford to be wrong. So the impulse would be to hit the enemy with everything you have so that you're not completely eliminated on the first strike, right? I mean, that would be the logic.
And one of the most destabilizing, ironically enough, one of the most destabilizing aspects of the nuclear triad in the United States is our missile silos on the Great Plains, because they can be taken out. The adversaries, whether it's Russia, China, other countries, know where they are down to the millimeter, and we'll take them out to eliminate their use in a war. And so the United States is vulnerable to have a big chunk of its triad taken out. They're probably going to launch all of them once the nukes start flying. Those are hydrogen bombs. Those are planet killers. And they're so vulnerable at being taken out before they can be launched that they will be launched immediately so that they can be used. That's the madness of this stuff.
You mentioned, Kevin Camps, that the Russians are building new weapon systems. The United States, in its arguments justifying its new weapon system, says, well, the Russians are doing it and we have to do it too. Both sides say the other one is basically responsible for initiating the problem. When we're listening to the Russian government officials, they point back to the 2002 decision by George W. Bush to eliminate the anti-ballistic missile treaty that prevented both sides from going forward with missile defense. And missile defense isn't defense. Missile defense is offense. If you can kill your enemy's incoming missiles, especially after maybe you've struck them first, if you can destroy the remnants of whatever they have left, then you can win. I mean, that's the whole concept of defensive weapons, not to really defend. Why did the U.S. leave the ABM, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty? Russia says that's the Garden of Eden, so to speak, in reverse for what's gone wrong in the last 16 years.
Well, I think the U.S., that U.S. exceptionalism, the U.S. thinks that it can throw its weight around, can protect itself. You know, at Reykjavik in Iceland in the late 1980s, the Reagan and Gorbachev administrations were very close to a nuclear weapons abolition agreement. And the holdup was Reagan's insistence at the behest of his advisors, no, we need the Strategic Defense Initiative. We need Star Wars. We need to protect ourselves. If he had let that go, Gorbachev was ready to abolish nuclear weapons. What a missed opportunity. That was a generation ago.
Who makes money off of nuclear weapons? I mean, it's such a sick, disgusting thing to profit from. I mean, the possible end of human civilization.
Name the biggest companies in the country, Lockheed Martin. I'm more, you know, a nuclear power kind of guy, so I don't have the whole list in my head. But it's a lot of major companies that make parts of nuclear weapons and have for decades.
We're out of time. I just want to suggest, Kevin, that next week we take up this issue of North Korea, because you're letting the audience know Russia has offered a non-plutonium generating nuclear power plant as an alternative to a power plant that could create that which is necessary for nuclear weapons. You're saying, look, why go nuclear at all? Why not use the Korean coastline to use wind power, for instance, to generate renewable energy sources? I want to talk more about that. I want to get into that and probe that more, to talk about what's feasible, what's realistic. Again, these are options that no one is talking about. And of course, it may be hard to talk about it in the context of big power conflict and big power sort of showdowns. But nonetheless, all of these things are real options. Let's talk about that next week as we continue our discussion on this segment of Loud and Clear called Beyond Nuclear. We talk every week with Kevin Camps. He is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. Go to their website, beyondnuclear.org. We were also joined this week by Walter Smolarek, sitting in for Nicole Roussel, who normally joins us on this segment. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.